Blog Talk Radio.
We would like to welcome you to Missing Pages of History. This show is dedicated to be a vehicle for underserved communities to give them information where they can use and to fill in all of these missing pages that have been missing for many, many, many years.
Hello.
Tonight, we will continue our discussion, part three of the history of policing in the United States. And with us, we have our analyst and contributor, Emmanuel. Emmanuel, welcome to Missing Pages of History.
Thank you.
Emmanuel, this is our third part of a four-part series dealing with the history of policing in the United States. And my follow-up question for this particular segment is, during the late 19th century and early 20th century, how can you explain the behavior of the police department? What was the behavior like during this time period?
In the late 19th and early 20th century, police were corrupt. They were, in fact, primarily, you might say, in the instrumentation for the creation of corruption in the first place. Police departments during the machine era provide a variety of community services other than law enforcement. We're going to talk a little bit about the public value during
exactly.
The police. Go ahead.
Yes, I could raise this whole issue of what was the public value of the police department during that time?
Well, some of the police behavior that particular time during the machine era, they provided a variety of community services other than law enforcement. And to be in particular that, I'm going to name out two cities, New York and Boston. They sheltered the homeless so they were safe. They kept tabs on infectious epidemics such as cholera, and also made sure that public privies were properly enforced and also safe. Now, these service functions, community service functions, our police continue to be important today. But I understand that this was in the context of the political machine. Government services were traded for votes and police loyalty. There's no doubt that these services were of public value. I'm going to repeat that. No doubt that these police services I just enumerated were of public value, but they must be viewed as primarily political acts designed to curry public favor and ensure the continued dominance of their political patrons.
Emmanuel, I know also during this time we're talking about the era of prohibition. What was the behavior during the prohibition period as relates to this time period?
Well, backtracking just a little bit, the advent of prohibition, we're talking about a century and a half, 1919 to 1933, only made the situation of the machine area and corruption more visible and made the situation worse. Well, let's explain that a little bit. Let's put some contents on that. The outlawing of alcohol, combined with the fact that the overwhelming majority of urban residents, they drink. And they will continue to drink. And that created new opportunities for police corruption. I'm going to repeat that. It's very important during this particular prohibition, talking the prohibition period, 1919 to 1933. The outlawing of alcohol, combined with the fact that the overwhelming majority of urban residents, they drink. And they wish to continue drinking. But what it did was created more opportunities for police corruption. And what it did was change substantially the focus of that corruption. Lawlessness became more open, more organized, and more blatant, along with police brutality. This during the prohibition period. Let's take our major cities. That's New York, to say Chicago, put it up here. They had about 20,000 speakeasies. They were basically taverns, bars, nightclubs, this type of thing. And they were operating in them. The illegal alcohol, drugs, racketeering, all this drug distribution was operating in these speakeasies. Corruption became total, became very total. The most important to policing, police marked a change in how corruption was organized. Criminal syndicates set up to deliver alcohol to all these illegal outlets, the speakeasies, etc., required enormous sums of money, number one, political power in their own right, and no longer depended on machines' largesse and respectability. So organized crime was able to emerge from the shadows and deal directly with corrupt police departments. It came a new opportunity, a stream of revenue. So in most cities, and in many cities, police became little more than watchmen for organized crime enterprises. That's what they were. They were police operatives working for criminal organized organizations and criminal syndicates. Enforcement squads were hired to harass the competition of the syndicate paying the corruption bills. It became more of a sinister van than ever before. And by the end of Prohibition, the corrupting and corruption of police, American policing, was almost total.
Emmanuel, in terms of looking at the corruption within the police department, there also came possibly a call for reforms. What type of reforms took place as a result of this behavior of the police department in the area of corruption? What kind of forms took place?
Well, initially, reform efforts took the form of investigative commissions, looking into both police and political corruption. Now, as it is today, these commissions were formed in response to a specific act of outrageous conduct by the police. This is why they were formed. And like today, these commissions investigate specific incidents, uncover widespread corruption. These is what they do. They also investigate misfeasance and malfeasance. Also, they also, as of today, because of outrageous perpetrated acts by the Peninsula Police Department, the cry for reform is still today. Dismantled police department started all over again because it's so corrupt. I'm going to give you an example of a Pacific outrage. And going to look at L.A., Los Angeles. We're going to look at a prostitution syndicate. One of the investigative commissions looked at that. And what happened was, that particular time, the mayor, police chief, and a local organized crime figure combined with subsequent instructed to the police to harass the syndicate's competitors in the prostitution industry. What happened was the assassination of an organized crime figure. And I'll give you his name. His name was Arthur Ronstein. By Police Lieutenant Charles Becker, he was head of the vice squad. So this is an indication of what was going on in that particular time. Assassinations, police harassing senators' competitors. And the third thing I want to talk to you about happened in Philadelphia. That's one example. A dispute between the mayor and the district attorney of Philadelphia, each of whom controlled rival gambling syndicates. The mayor and the district attorney of Philadelphia, and each of whom used loyal factions of the police, used the police to do the harassing.
Emmanuel, can you talk just a little bit more about the investigated commission in terms of the type of crimes that they had to investigate? 1894
to up to today? Well, first of all, let's talk about the investigative commission. The first one was in 1894. It was called the Lenox, L-E-N-O-X Committee, formed in 1894 to investigate police corruption. Related to what? Gambling, prostitution and police extortion. These charges were leveled at the police department of New York. The Lenox Committee also determined that promotions within the department required a bribe of $1,600 to be promoted to sergeant. They weren't earned, they were sold. Bribery, what you want to call it, but become a sergeant. Now to become a captain, the price of the bribe is almost $15,000. So this was one of the investigations they were performing in 1894. Subsequently, investigatory commissions in New York City include several committees. So I'm going to enumerate these for you as close as I can when they got started. In New York City, the Curate Committee in 1913, what they investigate? Collusion, gambling, prostitution. In 1932, they called the Seabury Committee, S-E-A-B-U-R-Y, they investigated prohibition, related corruption. That was their primary. Prohibition in 1932. Remember, probation was 1919 to 1933. So, 1930, this commission was hired to investigate prohibition and related corruption. In 1949, the Brooklyn Grand Jury, which investigated gambling payoffs, in 1949, there's a commission came out in 1972 called the Knapp Commission, which looked into corruption related to gambling and drugs. In 1993, the Marlin Commission, which they exposed and investigated the latest in corruption, prostitution, for such massive corruption and drug corruption in 1992. That was their largest investigation into drug corruption. Why? Because it was organized theft by police officers. They also exposed excessive use of force. And lastly, what they exposed was the use of drugs by the police departments. In Philadelphia, last but not least, a series of investigative grand juries exposed massive police collaboration with gambling and prostitution enterprises. They also investigated police corruption in these following cities: Louisville, Kentucky, San Francisco, Milwaukee, New Orleans, Indianapolis, and Atlanta, and Los Angeles. So more recently, the Christopher Commission investigated police misconduct in Los Angeles related to the widespread use of excessive force by LAPD and racism within the ranks of that department.
You know, Emmanuel, on a national basis, on the national basis, when we look at these commissions and the nature of the reforms, what was the resistance to these kind of reforms on a national basis? What was the history of that aspect of these commissions?
Well, the police department continues to do that today on a bureaucratic entity. They're resistant to both outside influence and reform because, again, they're locked in on the same page, the DA, the prosecutors, the police department. You can see what's going on today when the police do basically murder in the streets, catch it on camera, and again, the bureaucratic entity basically handpicks the grand jury to a certain extent. They court the media to a certain extent. And, of course, the police union do a lot of, you might say, not upholding type stuff, the truth. So this influence, outside influence and reform, well, of course they resist to both of these. Because now the dominance and control is being monitored. On a national basis, like you were saying, President Hoover, he appointed a commission called the Wickersham Committee in 1929, that's prior to Prohibition, to examine the rise in crime rate and police ineffectiveness in dealing with crime. Well, it was the first official government body to investigate organized crime in 1929, the Wickersham Commission. And what the commission was doing was shedding light on the extent of corruption and also serving to inform the public to have little lasting impact on police practices. You see what happened today. They shoot one, shoot another one. It has little impact on their practice, what they're doing today. So some other attempts to reform policing have come from within the ranks of the department themselves. They're trying to rectify things. First you got to reform the police commissioners. You got to reform them first. And the chiefs. So, and they get appointed sometime in the wake of scandals. They step down, they resign. That's what they do. They're not making efforts to change the nature of the police bureaucracy itself by just changing people out. Well, that's not the way to do it. You got to have some selection standards. You can't use nepotism, relationships, police operatives to do this. Right? It's got to be dismantled. Next they got to do is train them much better. Training for the new recruits got to be totally different. Again, we can't look at nepotism. We cannot look at relations. You cannot, because my father was one, my grandfather was one. You can't look at this at all. Throw that out the window. And place police, which they are now, on the civil service. And reward promotion as a result of testing. These are some of the reforms they basically put in place now, put in place then. And what they're going to, what is the, you know, the outcome of results of doing this? What kind of results are you hoping for? Well, the hope of these reforms basically is to lessen the hold of politicians and leaders on the police force. So if these processes doesn't work, then you got to govern by an objective criteria. So once the officers owe their job to someone, like the politicians, or owe their job to the police chief or someone, again, who recruited them, or political operatives, you're going to have this. This is what's going on today. What we're going to try to do... Go ahead.
Yes, I'm going to interject right here because I would like for you to give some clarity to the whole issue of recently reports have indicated that there are less people are committing less crime within communities of color, but yet the incarceration rate is still going up. Is there a parallel history between what you have learned from this history and what's going on today? Because, you know, less crimes are being committed, but yet more people are being incarcerated. How do you explain that phenomenon, understanding the history that you have just presented to the public?
Well, first you got to talk about the opportunities. I talked about drinking was an opportunity. Well, what are the opportunities today? Well, you have two. Traffic, tickets, and you have drugs. Those two today are the ones that they basically are tackling to fill the cells up. These two, there are no hope. Drugs to be planted in their pockets when they're searching them. That's why it says frisk, serve, you know, frisk and frisk, stop and frisk. Well, stop and frisk is another opportunity. Who are they stopping and who are they frisking? Again, they're creating crime because crime pays. It creates money, a stream of money, a revenue for the police officers who were police officers to retire in Arizona, the Floridas, the North Carolina, they can retire with great benefits. They have to keep that up. They don't want to stop this. So where's the money train coming from? The money train got to come from some opportunities. What are the opportunities? Driving, traffic, drugs. Not that much from gambling, because gambling, again, is controlled. But it's got to come from another opportunity. Opportunities, while they're locking them up now, over 75% of people in the prison today are basically on drug charges and traffic charges. That's where the revenue is coming in, especially to smaller cities like Ferguson. Almost 70% of Ferguson, the money they create for revenue is coming from traffic tickets. Traffic. New York, 850,000 tickets are written. They're going to throw them out the window. Over 95% was written in underserved communities, communities of color. People had the less amount of cars, the least amount of money. They lose their job. This is the recourse after that. They lose their job. They have a felony. They have a what's called a high misdemeanor. The job is lost. They come back. They have to commit a crime to get some money, whatever they need to do. You messes a person's whole life up sometimes by making some crazy arrest. And they do it all the time now. They have a quota. They tell you they don't, but they do. They have to make so many stops, so many traffic stops they have to make to create that money. This is why. This is a clear internal chain of command. See, what we got to do, we got to isolate structurally police officers from politicians. So what we need, if we need a middle management on organizational charts, I don't know. Change the geographic lines, a police precinct's proviso. So a lot of these things can be done. Special squads to perform special duties within the department. And again, they have centralized a lot of these squads. Traffic, narcotics. So these are kind of things they're looking at now to make sure the revenue stream keep coming. And again, if they don't fill these cells in the state prisons with these private enterprises, then the taxpayers, they put bill for every day that cell is empty. So one way or the other, crime pays.
Emmanuel, can I get you to speak to your analysis of when you're saying that earlier in one of your presentations, you mentioned the issue of the premise for policing were mainly emphasizing social control over criminal control. And we also see there's a large segment of young people going into these institutions because they cannot no longer pay maybe their child support. And they are being incarcerated. And as a result of being incarcerated, they cannot no longer either get their job back or they have lost their job. These kind of policies, what is the motivation behind these kind of policies? As well as they have policies now where the inmates have to pay themselves to stay in prison for their cap in prison. Is this a continuation of this whole question of using this institution as a means to make money?
Of course. Yeah, this is, it's all part of capitalism. You got to find areas where a stream of revenue has to be spent and make sure who benefits from this. Then you got to pick a ethnic group, basically, disproportionate to the population percentage. African Americans, by 12.5% of the population, we incarcerated over 60%. Why? What causes this? Let's investigate this. But they don't want to do that. See, the thing is that police professionalism, there's got to be the better way to do it. The community should have police officers from that community, by and large. If it's 6 to 7% African American, it should be 6 to 7% police force, fire department. This should be African American, Hispanic, Latino. It should represent that particular community, not totally one side. The police department through this country is over 90% white, Caucasian, European. That's what's wrong with the system. They are trained, minded, and their police executives need to restructure the department itself. Because right now it's still bureaucratic. And they have an internal clear chain of command. But again, I said before, we got to structurally isolate police from politicians. And again, we got to change the geographic lines. They do it for voting, so it'd be one-sided. They do everything they can to make sure that they stay in absolute power and corrupt. They're going to make sure they stay corrupt. Because as long as you stay corrupt, you're going to make money. Corruption breeds money. The police department is corrupt. The prison system is corrupt. The healthcare system is corrupt. Everything basically is corrupt in capitalism to make money. You cannot make money in capitalism being honest. It doesn't work. It does not work. You started off stealing and taking, and we could continue going to do that. We steal, we take, and we lie. We can continue doing that. If we don't like who's in charge, we're going to tell a lot of lies. Whether it's truth or not, we're going to get it out, and we'll apologize later. We want to get it out there because the word apology, see, that's our mainstay for correctness, is by apologizing. That's supposed to correct things. And you have a long history of corrupting things, Americans do. We started out wrong, and we're going to continue to be wrong. We started out wrong with slavery. We started out wrong taking everything from the Indians, just taking it. We just take it, and we can't claim it ours. But nobody want to talk to Sitting Bull. Nobody want to talk to Bald Eagle, because they are the father of this country, not George Washington. We just take these overlaying words with a lie and try to make it history and make people believe that when the history is out there, big time. And that's our job, to show the mission page of history. You got what you got with corruption, stealing, and lying. Everybody knows that. Historians know that, like myself. We know it all, how it all began, and how it ends, is ending. But again, it's all about power, it's all about money, it's all about corruption, it's always going to be that. We got to find a better way, the right way. We're not looking for the right way, we look for the wrong way, and how to execute the lies through the media. That's what we do today. We can see what happened, we look at it, and we'll try to find a way. A person is running away from the police because he's afraid. He fears for his life. Shoots him in the back and say, he assaulted me. When? Where was the camera then? Telling that lie. But this is what we have to stop. Professionalism is not there because, again, they govern by objective criteria. And they owe their job to someone, their loyalty to someone. And most of them owe their loyalty to ranks in the political arena.
Well, I say, Emmanuel, in closing, can you just give us a recap for today's program as we discuss the history of policing in the United States?
But what we got to do basically is stop from this greater centralization of police function and stop placing the emphasis on military-style organization. That would happen in Ferguson. It's a military-style organization, and they got to be disciplined much more. They have to get more into crime control and efficiency. They need efficiency to achieve this crime control. You see a person selling loose cigarettes, you're not supposed to kill them and put chokeholds and stuff and jump on him. You know, talk. We don't do that because, again, we think sometimes police, once they get a uniform on, the emphasis is basically on being a military-style organization. We need closer supervision of police officers. More foot patrols. Get to know the community. And again, you got to integrate the police force in cities that are 50%, 60%, 70% African American. We got to make sure the force is 80% or 90% African American, not 80%, 90% white. Basically, we got to decentralize the command functions and at the headquarters. But like I said again, professionalism very intensified. And the police and the communities they serve sometimes, they have to create, they create dissension. They create rancor. And the police create that same in the department. So when you get blacks and white police officers together, there is some dissension. The crime control tactics are totally different. The aggressive stop and frisk procedures I was talking about earlier, that creates community resentment. Because what are you doing today? Go up on Wall Street and do it. Go up there and do what you do. Not going to do that up there. And that's particularly among young minority males. They are most frequently targeted. Their military model of policing is also come with repression. So, again, as you move into the latter part and early part of the 21st century, police reform has taken some steps. And in some cities, but smaller cities, they still, police departments are still bureaucratic, inward-looking, isolated from the public, and they are very defensive. And everything they do, they have a lot to tell you.
We have to stop you on that note, Emmanuel, as a contributor, analyst, and historian on Missing Pages of History. We will continue the discussion on the 17th of October, and we discuss the four part of a four part series on policing in the United States. But before we close out, there's a couple of announcements we'd like to make. One thing, Missing Pages of History, we'd like to honor and recognize ongoing celebration this weekend as relates to Southern Baptist Church, located 1400 Idaway Avenue in Richmond, Virginia. They're celebrating 25 years of Pastor James Henry Harris and Lady D. Harris. Congratulations to their 20 years of being the pastor at the church. Congratulations to the community and all that they have done to the community. And also, we'd like to encourage the listening audience to come out next weekend to the 20th anniversary of the Many Men March. Particularly, there's a special event that will take place from 7-Eleven. That's the Kwame Ture Brigade at Malcolm X Park. We'd like to encourage you to come out to that event as it participate in the 20th anniversary of the Many Men March. For more information, you can go to www.a-aprp.gc.org. And also, there has been an extension to date of Mississippi History fundraiser raffle drawing, which will take place on Saturday, October the 17th at WCLM 1450 AM, Richmond, Virginia. Therefore, you have time to purchase your tickets if you have them. Also, there's an ongoing fundraiser by Mississippi History. Get your cap and t-shirt drive. For more information, we invite you to go to our website at www.mphinc.org, or you can email us at missingpagesofhistory1@yahoo.com. As well as, don't forget, you can watch a live TV show on Comcast Television, channel 95, from 9 to 10 p.m. We'd like to thank all those who have supported us and those who would like to support us. Again, you can go to our website at www.mphinc.org. Until the 17th, we'd like to thank you for allowing us to come to your home this evening. And remember, let's continue to fill in those missing pages of history. We'll see you on the 17th.